All right, let's talk about education. We're here in the midsummer. Now, for the kiddies who might be listening, all right, it's July already. Surprise! We're going to blink our eyes. It's going to be August, and you're going to be going back to school at some point. Boo! Okay, come on, don't do that.
Well, but football season. Yay!
Well, football season. So, I mean, yay, there we go.
The good with the bad.
So we want to welcome back to our program Jill Barshe from the Hechinger Report that covers education topics across the country. First off, Jill, welcome back, and thanks for taking some time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
You're very welcome. For longtime regular listeners, we've had Jill on a couple of times before. I don't know, Jill, and I just called this midsummer. So obviously schools are closed, it's summer break, teachers are enjoying themselves and whatever. So I figure midsummer is like sleepy time for you. You're just not doing a whole lot.
Is that what you figure?
Would that be accurate, Jill, or not?
I think this timing of summer is a regional issue. Here in New York City, school just got out about a week ago. So we're early summer.
Okay, whoa. Is that a week ago? Okay, you exaggerating or is that true?
Well, I mean, I can look it up, but I think school just ended the third week of June. And so what, we just started July, about a week ago.
Oh, my gosh. Now, I've always believed this, or I've thought this, right? Is it a state law in New York that you cannot start the new school year until after Labor Day? Isn't that a state law up your way?
I would love to look that up. I have no idea, but it's a long tradition in the East Coast that we don't start school till after Labor Day. You get the whole summer. I don't understand the rest of the country that starts in August, which is very much summertime to me.
I am with you on that.
Well, I tell you what, I used to work with schools with my old job, and I've got friends all over the country. Down in Georgia, I think South Carolina, not sure about Florida, they actually start the new school year the first week of August. That's when they start.
Word. The first week
The first
of
week of August.
That's insane.
All right. And then they finish, I guess, like early to mid-May, and they're all done. So, yeah, I've always thought that's crazy, too. So I'm assuming all the schools have air conditioning down there because the first week of August down there has got to be really hot.
Oh,
anyway, okay, let's
go. It's interesting what the rest of the world does, right? They don't have these long summers. In Germany and UK and France and other places, I think they just have about a month off during the summertime. And then they spread the rest of the vacation around the year, so you have longer holiday periods. And the great part of that is you don't get as much learning loss during these extended vacations.
Yep. No, I think that makes a ton of sense. I really do. I don't know why.
Really?
What? Yeah.
You've got a little guy.
Yeah, I do think the summer jobs play into it here because we want the kiddos as lifeguards and working at the amusement parks and those sorts of things. But again, I adjust the schedules a little bit. I think that's a much better way to go because I do think that learning loss is fairly substantial here over the summer break.
Okay. You go home and talk to Reggie about that. See what he has
to say.
Well,
we keep a pretty regular schedule with our keeping him up to date on reading and working on different math problems for that very reason. You don't want to have to kind of start over, which it feels like we kind of do here every September. Or late August, isn't it?
Bravo. Good parent. Bravo.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Good parent. All right, Joe, for folks that have not heard you on our program before, let's briefly start. Tell us something about yourself. Obviously, we know you're from New York. What exactly do you cover? And tell us about the Hechinger Report exactly. What is all that?
I work for a nonprofit news organization called the Hechinger Report, and we cover one topic only, and you can probably guess what it is. It's education. We are funded through philanthropies and donations by readers, and we produce stories that are on our website, but we also have a model where we partner with mainstream media publications that you've heard of, regional papers all over the country, public radio stations. Our pieces are in the New York Times, on NBC News, PBS, The Atlantic Magazine. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of publications. And so it's wonderful. We have a very small newsroom of about 20 people, but our reach is extensive.
I've mentioned before when we've had you on, I love your stuff. I mean, very thorough reporting that I'm not getting anywhere else about education. And I happily am a small contributor because I think you folks do really, really good stuff.
We appreciate that.
All right. Jill, let me just start with an open-ended, very general question, and you can be as factual or as opinionated as you want to be, okay? And that is, essentially, what is, and you cover primarily K to 12 school stuff, okay? What, I don't know, what is the state of K to 12 education today? Because seemingly chaos, I'm hearing that word thrown in, and this is happening over here, and this is happening over there, and oh my gosh, and you know all this stuff. Your opinion, just sort of what is the general state of education in our country today? Go right ahead.
There's been a significant deterioration in student achievement. It started a bit before the pandemic hit, and it exacerbated. It deteriorated rapidly after the pandemic, and we're still not climbing out of this hole. And so we see deteriorations in reading achievement, particularly among middle schoolers. We're seeing problems with math achievement. That's particularly in a sorry state. And it's really hard to understand the causes of it. We've been back from pandemic. We've been in school full time for quite a while now. And why is it that we're not reclaiming this lost ground? Some people blame instruction. Some people blame the quality of the teacher labor force, that teaching's become a less desired profession to go into. Other people blame technology and cell phones, and we have a society of mass distraction. I think a huge problem right now is students have disengaged with school. Chronic absenteeism went through the roof with the pandemic. After students were told to come back into the classroom, we've got, you know, more than a quarter of students, almost 30% of students, who are just not coming to school regularly. And you can't learn if you're not showing up. And it's sort of become culturally acceptable not to go to school, and we really need to tackle that.
Are we putting blame there on parents at all? Hearing a lot of different. Are parents not responsible for their kiddos anymore?
I think it's a mass cultural issue that people don't think it's necessary to go to school anymore. And, you know, we're seeing it in the workplace, too, right? People don't want to return to the workplace from remote work. They think it's okay to stay home. And I don't know how much parental pressure there is on children to, you know, physically show up to school every day. That's a good question.
Yeah. I don't know. It feels like sometimes we're putting an awful lot on the educators and maybe not enough on the parents. In my mind, it needs to be a joint venture. And I mean, we're very fortunate in the area we live in and in the area I was raised in. Like we never. It really was never a thought that you can not go to school today if you don't want. And if not that we didn't have kids skip here or there, but the parents found out and there was immediate consequences to it. I don't know. I think, like a lot of these problems, I think they're multi-tiered, but I think a lot of it starts at home.
Well, and part of it is the public health messaging, right? If you don't feel well, if you have some sniffles, you should stay home, right? That you shouldn't spread your illness around and create some contagion. And then we also have the explosion of education technology that makes it easier, right, to skip school. So if you're just not feeling well or you're feeling like you need a mental health day, you know that you can still log into Google Classroom and see what your assignments were. There's this feeling like the ramifications, the consequences are not as serious.
Yeah, see, I wonder how much of this is somehow tied to technology. All right. Now, you just mentioned Google Classroom, which I've seen Google Classroom's great. All right. You can access things and so on, but maybe it's a fallback like, well, yeah, I don't need to go today. I'll just log on. Because, Jill, as I recall, when the pandemic started, God forbid, 5 years ago, schools were thrown into the situation of doing online learning, which was a disaster. I mean, it was, because those people that had to do it were forced into it, and they've never done it before. Like, poof, that you didn't have to turn your camera on. A school day you could complete in 2 hours. Well, why should I go to school for 7 hours if I can complete it all in 2 hours? So, Jill, I'm thinking technology has a lot to do with this situation. Does any of that sound right?
I think it's a big contributing factor for why students are not back in the classroom. And we're talking all kinds of students. It's not just low-achieving students who were disaffected and unmotivated in the past. We're talking even high-achieving, good students are just not in the classroom as regularly as they used to be. I would encourage you to look at the attendance figures in your own school district. I suspect you'll find they're much worse than they were, say, in 2019.
Now, I think earlier, Jill, you said 30%. What was that 30% figure?
So that's a rounded figure. I think we got it. I should look at the numbers, but my rough recollection is we got up to about, maybe 28% chronic absenteeism. And what that means is that 28% of K-12 students were absent for more than 10% of the school year. So we're talking about 18 days or more. And some are absent much more than that. Whereas before the pandemic, my recollection is the chronic absenteeism rate was more like 15%. So we're talking about half as many students were absent that much. Now we've come down a little bit from the peak. Maybe we're at 26, 27% now. I mean, it's inched down, but we're still so much higher than we traditionally have been.
Now, Jill, do you know that figure you just said, all right, that's a, like a national average figure. Is that
Yes. The
same for the whole country, or are certain areas of the country worse with this maybe than some other places?
Absolutely. There are some schools that are maybe have a 15% chronic absenteeism figure, meaning 15% of the students are absent from, 18 days or more a year. But if you look at their historical data, maybe it used to be 5 or 8% in the past. So, I mean, they've had a big jump. It's just a smaller number. And then if you look at some low-income schools, particularly schools now with large immigrant communities who are very fearful right now of ICE raids, the numbers can be much higher. I don't know the highest rates, but I wouldn't be surprised to see schools with 40, 50% chronic absenteeism.
Wow. All right, let me stick with technology-related questions because I was, by the way, the website, HechingerReport.org. All right. Hechinger is H-E-C-H-I-N-G-E-R, HechingerReport.org. So, Jill, I had to refresh my memory last night, so I logged on and put your name in there and saw some of your recent stories. You've had some stories recently about technology, about AI, all right, artificial intelligence. There was one story you did, all right, the headline is University Students Offload Critical Thinking and Other Hard Work to AI. Do us a favor, talk about that story. What did you cover in that?
There was this idea that artificial intelligence could really help students, help them plan their work, become a sort of personal tutor, help them understand things that they didn't understand in school. But there were two really interesting studies that came out this year that throw cold water on that dream. One of them is by one of the companies that creates an AI chatbot. It's called Anthropic, and their chatbot is called Claude. It's a rival to ChatGPT, which most people have heard of. And what they did was they looked at all the university addresses that were logging into Claude, so all the addresses that end with EDU, like Harvard EDU and University of Texas.edu. And they were able to filter out professors through some interesting filters. And they felt at the end they really just had a thousands and thousands of university students around the country. And then they looked at the actual chat transcript of the students with the chat box. And they looked at how students were really using it. And what they noticed is they were asking the chatbot to do their work for them, to actually do the writing for them, to give them the answers to a computer science assignment and give them the step-by-step explanation so that they could just parrot it back. That they, what students are not doing is the hard work of, you know, struggling a little bit and making sure they understand something themselves. They're using it as a crutch. And then there was a second study that I found fascinating. It was conducted in China, and they did it in a sort of laboratory where they have college students come in, and they said, please do this English writing assignment. We're going to give you a few reading passages, and then we want you to write an essay about them. There was a control group that got no help at all. There was a group that got a human tutor to help them. There was a group that just had some sort of checklist and reference materials about how to write a good essay and how to check your essay afterwards. And the fourth group got ChatGPT. And the ChatGPT kids did the worst. You know, they submitted the best essays. When you just looked at the essay they did, because they kind of cheated. They had ChatGPT write the essay for them. But later, when they were tested on what they actually absorbed from the reading passages and what they understood, it was the ChatGPT students who did the worst. And so it really is a sign that, you know, in the same way that Google searches can sometimes make us stupider, like we just search and then we forget afterwards, ChatGPT might be making us stupider, too.
And that's been the fear about AI ever since this thing kind of hit the fan about 3 years ago, right, Joe? You work with teachers, talk to teachers, and so on. This is what they've been fearing, and you're saying pretty much this, according to these studies, this is what's happening. Would that be correct?
That's how we're seeing students use it in the wild. Now, defenders of AI will say, oh, but if you use it properly, then students can learn more. But if you actually prompt the chatbot to teach you and then ask it to sort of quiz you afterwards and then you do it yourself, but you're asking students to have a level of discipline and self-control that's very unusual, because the typical situation for a student is they're late on their assignments, the deadlines are, you know, at midnight that night. They need to just get it done quickly so they don't fail the course. And so asking students to have the wherewithal to use ChatGPT properly just feels unrealistic. The other thing that defenders of AI in education say is, well, maybe we need to change the assignments. Teachers just can't issue the same assignments that are too easy to cheat on using ChatGPT. We need to create new assignments. And that's asking professors to reinvent education, and I don't know that we know how to do that.
All right, we'll take a break in a moment. Now, Jill, you travel to schools and so on. Have you encountered schools, they have firm rules somehow about AI usage with students? In other words, you cannot use it, or you can only do this, or you can only do that. Are there schools out there with firm rules now about this, or is it pretty much laissez-faire, like, yeah, go ahead, do what you like? Which is more prevalent there?
We see a lot of firm rules. I think it's more unusual to have a teacher say, do what you want. I see rules out there, but they are impossible to enforce. We have schools with honor codes that say if you're caught using ChatGPT, you'll automatically fail, or other kinds of consequences. But it's really hard to catch. Say you put the student's essay through a ChatGPT detector. Often the detectors don't detect it. In fact, you can run your ChatGPT written essay through ChatGPT again and tell it, please rewrite this in a way that no detector can detect that it was written by AI. and it will succeed.
Oh, the machines are going to get us, folks. Okay, holy mackerel. All right, let's take a quick break here. Again, our guest is Jill Barshay from the Hechinger Report, talking about education topics. Yeah, what a fun world those folks are having right now. Wow. You're listening to Let's Talk here on 98.7 The Fox. We've got more questions. Don't go anywhere. We will come right back.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox.
Interest rates and inflation are out of control. Is your credit card debt also out of control? It's time to resolve your debt and take back control for a lot less than what you owe. If you have $10,000 or more in credit card debt, then you need to call us right now. DebtFix Pros can significantly reduce the amount you owe, and you could be debt-free faster than you think.
I knew we had to do something. Our debt was growing.
It was getting out of control, and we just didn't know what to do.
We saw an ad for DebtFix Pros. We called, and they showed us how fast they could get us out of debt.
It really was amazing, and now we're back in control.
Call now, and we'll show you how easy it is to fix your debt. The call and consultation are free. Call DebtFix Pros right now. Call 800-930-0388. That's 800-930-0388. 800-930-0388. Our military heroes deserve our thanks. Patriotic Hearts is there to assist those in need, especially in the transition back to family and civilian life. You can help by donating an unwanted car, truck, SUV, or van. Your donation supports the programs that make a difference in the lives of veterans and those actively serving our country. Call today for a fast, free pickup. Your donation will not only be greatly appreciated, but will also qualify as a tax deduction. Call 800-917-1544 to help our military heroes. Call 800-917-1544. Operators are standing by 24/7. Patriotic Hearts, helping our soldiers and veterans live a better life. Call 800-917-1544. That's 800-917-1544. Together, we can make a difference.
Are you looking for the best pizza in town? Look no further than Brothers Pizza in downtown Belfont. Good, fast, and did I mention really good? Brothers Pizza also delivers to the immediate area, but you can also enjoy sit-down dining with convenient on-street parking. For fast, friendly delivery, call 355-5581 or stop by at 102 North Allegheny Street in downtown Belfont. Brothers Pizza, downtown Belfont.
Have you checked out our new website, 987thefox.info? When you do, be sure to scroll to the bottom, enter your email address. Then sometime soon, you'll be a 987 The Fox insider with our newsletter feature, thoughts from some of our hosts that you won't get on our shows, messages from sponsors, and even special deals as an insider newsletter exclusive. We'll take good care of your email address, no sharing or selling. Hope you'll join us on 987thefox.info and enter your email address at the bottom. Be an insider, only from 987 The Fox.
Interest rates and inflation are out of control. Is your credit card debt also out of control? It's time to resolve your debt and take back control for a lot less than what you owe. If you have $10,000 or more in credit card debt, then you need to call us right now. DebtFix Pros can significantly reduce the amount you owe, and you could be debt-free faster than you think.
I knew we had to do something. Our debt was growing.
It was getting out of control, and we just didn't know what to do.
We saw an ad for DebtFix Pros. We called, and they showed us how fast they could get us out of debt.
It really was amazing, and now we're back in control.
Call now, and we'll show you how easy it is to fix your debt. The call and consultation are free. Call DebtFix Pros right now. Call 800-930-0388. That's 800-930-0388. 800-930-0388.
Save big and head to your local Toro dealer, Maxwell Equipment, for the spring sales event going on now. Stop in today and get up to $1,500 off select Z-Master mowers and Grandstand, Multi-Force, Stand-Ons, plus $500 off select attachments. Visit Maxwell Equipment on Shiloh Road for more details on promotions and financing offers. Toro, count on it.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox.
It's Let's Talk here on a Thursday, our last show of the week as we are off tomorrow to celebrate America's birthday, and we'll be back on Monday with a brand new Let's Talk.
Yeah, I'm training to challenge Joey Chestnut.
There you
go. Tomorrow's his day. Joey Chestnut. He's the guy that eats all the hot dogs.
Get her done.
I think I can get to two or three.
We're looking for you to get to 81.
Oh, my God.
In, what is it, 10 or 12 minutes?
I mean, it's ridiculous, but anyway.
With the bias.
All right, let's talk some more education with our guest, Jill Barshe from the Hechinger Report. Again, their website, folks, is HechingerReport.org, H-E-C-H-I-N-G-E-R. HechingerReport.org. If you're interested at all in education, you get kids in school or you don't have kids in school, really good stuff. Definitely check out their website.
Yep.
All right, now, Jill, you've had a series of stories this year about the U.S. Department of Education and either the dismantling of that department or the changes in that department and so on. I don't know, just sort of, I guess, boil down, because you've had multiple stories about what's going on down there in D.C. What's your findings about what's been happening with that department? Maybe start with what's been happening with that department and then some of the, you know, the after effects and so on. What about those folks?
Well, thank you for asking about that. That's been a real priority in my coverage this year. I usually write about education research and data reports, and I have a weekly column called Proof Points where this is what I've been doing for a dozen years. And for any of your listeners out there, if you're interested in what education research and data show, you can sign up for my free newsletter. I hope it's okay that I plugged that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Of course. Yeah.
So you just go onto our website and you'll see a sign-up link, and it's just a once-a-week newsletter that you'll get on Monday morning. But suddenly, I believe it was the evening of February 10th, I start seeing all these messages on social media and in my inbox, and my world turns upside down. The area that I'm covering is being decimated. And the first step was when Elon Musk's Doge group just started willy-nilly canceling contracts for statistics. The Department of Education runs the third largest statistical agency in the federal government after the U.S. Census and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they do basic things like count the number of students, count the number of teachers, track how much students are learning. And they just killed all these contracts. Unlike other statistical agencies, the work is not done in-house at the Department of Education. They use private organizations. It's contracted out to vendors. And those were the contracts, 89 of them, they canceled. And except for a handful of data collections, they killed everything. And it was so shocking because people expected the Trump administration to kill maybe some woke studies on diversity, equity, and inclusion. We expected them to attack some things. But who suspected basic data collection and things that Congress mandates in statute? It was utterly shocking. So I started to cover that. A couple weeks later, they fired the commissioner for National Center of Education Statistics. That's the person who runs that division, who has a congressionally mandated six-year term that's supposed to straddle administrations and be nonpartisan, but they, you know, just fired her and, you know, made her leave the building. And then about a week and a half after that, they fired half the employees of the education department. So there were just no one, and not only throughout the department, they fired 90% of the employees in the research and statistics division. So there was just no one left to do this work, to research how we best learn math, how we best learn reading. It was just really shocking. So I covered all of those steps. it's really hard to understand the consequences because a lot of these statistics collections take years to put together. And so we'll be really feeling the impact of this maybe a couple years from now. But there's a few things that we've noticed. The department is supposed to, by law, produce an annual report on the condition of education in America. And it's supposed to be done by June 1st. They completely missed the deadline. And I started emailing the department what's going on. And they slapped a few things together on the website saying, oh, some tables are forthcoming. We're not going to do it as a single report anymore. We'll do it kind of on a rolling basis. We're seeing that there are things that can't be completed because there is no commissioner for statistics right now. So I'm starting to track the thing. You know, at one point they were going to dismantle a library. It used to be transmitted by microfiche to all the libraries around the country. It's now an online website where really important educational documents are housed. They were going to let funding run out for that, but it was something I reported on, and they agreed to restart funding. And what we've just been seeing, because there are lawsuits that researchers have been waging against the Department of Education, that they are quietly restarting some of these statistical collections. So I'm starting to feel hopeful now that DOGE is not quite out of the picture completely, but tamped down a bit, and the Education Secretary, Linda McMahon, seems quite supportive of a lot of this work, that some of the critical work will come back online again.
Are you confident that's going to keep happening?
No. And some of it's coming back with a much diminished budget. Like, for example, one of the things they promised to protect was something called NAEP. That's the National Assessment for Educational Progress. This is the nation's report card that every time it comes out, every couple years, it's a front page story about how U.S. students are doing. It's why I could say earlier in the segment that U.S. academic achievement has deteriorated because of this test. She said, we are protecting them. But behind the scenes, they were slashing. They had to cut a lot of the assessments that were planned. And we still don't understand what kind of corners are going to need to be cut in the analysis and the administration of this test in future years. It's something I'll be keeping an eye on.
Jill, I'm curious now. This is Scott. Let me be honest with you, okay? And I've mentioned this on our show here before. In my old job, I worked 25 years primarily with schools, and I had a chance to do things with administrators and teachers and all this sort of thing. Those folks on the ground are not fans of bureaucracy. And I looked at the Federal Department of Education as another level of bureaucracy. Like, okay, here we go. Although research, again, I don't understand the cuts in research. We got to gather information. Okay, this works over here. Well, this isn't working over here. So the cuts in research, I don't understand. Now, Jill, have you ever done any reporting on state departments of education, like Pennsylvania, New York? I assume every state has one of those. And is it maybe, what's the word I want, redundant between a state department of education and a federal department of education? They're like doing the same thing. And why are they doing the same thing? Now, maybe I'm completely wrong on that. Have you ever done any kind of like reporting on state departments of education as compared to the feds?
It's a really good question. A small amount of money that schools have, around 11-12% of it, comes from the federal government. Most of the money that schools have comes locally from local property taxes or the state government. And so for this money that the federal government gives, there are a lot of regulations around it. And there's a lot of reporting that schools have to do. And just like doctors sometimes feel buried in paperwork, schools sometimes feel buried in paperwork. They have to hire people to do this paperwork. And why is the federal government so prescriptive that, you know, when you use this Title I money for high poverty students, why do you have to use it in these certain ways? or when they get money for children with disabilities, there's a lot of regulations that surround that. And wouldn't it be more efficient if we just let the schools or local leaders spend it the way they see fit? And that's really compelling. Let's get rid of the red tape. Let's get rid of the bureaucracy. I get that. But, you know, Scott, we recently had an experience where we just gave schools a lot of money. During the pandemic, we had these pandemic recovery funds. We gave schools $190 billion. It was enormous. And what do we have to show for it, right? We've seen a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse. We've seen schools spending it on sports stadiums. And we haven't seen a huge increase in academic achievement as a result of it. So here's the problem, that if you still want the federal government to give them money, what do you do about accountability? Do you just let schools waste the money and spend it how they see fit without control?
That's a good question. All right. Accountability, it should be, you know, in the mix there somewhere. I mean, I've seen some schools, they fixed up their schools, not sports stadiums. They put in air conditioning or they refurbished the building because it was crumbling and stuff like that. Yeah, Congress was handing out obscene amounts of money to schools and so on. So I don't know. Just Joe, I'll be honest. I'm torn on the Fed Department of Education thing. Yes, research. We should always be doing research. Again, what's working? What's not working? These folks did this. These folks did that. That could be done on a national level. But I just have wondered about redundancy between the feds. And in our case, the people in Harrisburg, are they pretty much doing the same thing? And then the folks on the ground, it's like, okay, who are we supposed to listen to here? You know, we got two to listen to.
I don't think there's much redundancy in doing the same task. The big complaint I hear is there's so much bureaucratic red tape and paperwork to comply with the federal regulations. The federal government is not deciding what should be taught in schools. They're not dictating lessons. They're not setting curriculum. They're not setting standards. That's what's being done on the state and local level. I don't see redundancy on that level.
All right. Have you done any reporting on cyber schools? Because I guess especially since the pandemic, they have risen in popularity, and they have their own issues. I know a lot of local school folks are not fans of cyber schools for a bunch of reasons. Have you done any kind of reporting on that?
What I've seen is the research on these online cyber schools, and what we see is that student achievement is much lower. They seem not to be serving students well. Of course, you can find anecdotally an example of an individual student, perhaps a student who's socially struggling at school and maybe thriving more in an online environment. But I think those cases are few and far between, and that the majority of students are not doing so well in them.
Is anybody complaining about this? Like, hey, maybe we shouldn't be doing this anymore? Is somebody stepping up to say, hey, if the kids aren't doing as well academically, why are we doing this?
I definitely have seen protests and complaints. The teachers' unions have been active in that. I think you'd have to look at it across. This is a debate that's happening on the state level, and there are 50 separate debates on it. Some states don't allow these cyber charters at all, and some do. I believe your state is one that has some pretty active cyber schools.
Yes, we've got several. So that's one reason I kind of tossed that question out there. A term we've mentioned a bunch of times is the enrollment cliff, which is supposed to mean there's fewer kids coming out of school going to college. All right, folks are having fewer kids. From your perspective, right, the enrollment cliff, is that actively affecting education right now? Is this something that's going to burst, I don't know, 5 years from now or so on, or is this much ado about nothing? What about that topic?
We're in the midst of it right now, and it's going to get a lot worse. We have to do a little bit of math right now to understand this. The peak baby year was around 2007, 2008, and after that, we stopped making as many babies in this country. And so you have to count 18 years from that. So the peak, the kids who were born in the peak are now sort of juniors and seniors in high school. And but there's far fewer, say, sophomore, freshmen, eighth graders, seventh graders. As it cascades down, there are fewer and fewer students. So it feels to me in about 2 or 3 years, we're really going to be feeling the impact of it now. Where you see it is where fertility rates decline before the peak. We have had far fewer babies in the Northeast for quite some time, and you very much see among small liberal arts colleges in New England that used to be thriving institutions, they are desperate for students right now. Also the upper Midwest, areas that have seen the declining fertility rate for quite some time. Nationally, that was offset by strong baby production in Texas and the West and Florida, and that was sort of offsetting it. But nationally, we're going to be really hitting it in a couple of years.
All right. Now, Jill, here's a crazy thought, because, I mean, is this a negative? If we have fewer kids in some schools, smaller class sizes, I always thought that's supposed to be a good thing. Maybe I have this backwards. I mean, do most education professionals think that this cliff, this slow decrease in the number of students, it's going to be a bad thing? I'm wondering, is it possible it could actually be a good thing, or am I just wrong there?
If money were no object, that would be a good thing, because if schools had ample budgets, it would be great to have these smaller class sizes. The problem is that school funding is based on headcount. And when enrollments go down, schools get less money. But meanwhile, they have this infrastructure that they built up during the baby boom of the 2000s. And it's very hard to unwind that. I mean, imagine that you've built a large house and you've got utility bills that you have to, that you need to support that. And I don't know, pretend you're rich and you've got gardeners and a house staff and all that. And at some point, as the number of people in your household diminishes, you have to somehow downsize that whole infrastructure and at the same time pay pensions and health care benefits for all these teachers that you had been hiring along the way.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. All right, these upcoming years are going to be interesting. Before we let you go, Jill, again, we'll mention the website, HechingerReport.org. Really good stuff there. I don't know, you got a hot story you're working on right now or an upcoming story like, hey, watch out for this one? You know, give us a little preview if you got something.
I'm looking right now at some consequences, good and bad, to what is going on with the dismantling of the Education Department. This coming Monday, July 7th, after the holiday, I'll be talking about a hiccup that has happened, but also a victory for education researchers.
All right. Well, Jill, like I said, I've been chasing you for 2 months. You're one busy lady. Holy mackerel.
So, a lot going on.
Yeah. Now, hopefully we'll have you on again maybe in a few months or something because, yeah, education – it's an interesting world right now, isn't it? Oh, boy. So we appreciate your time this morning, and, hey, have a happy 4th of July. Thanks for joining us.
You too, and thank you for having me on again, and thank you for your patience. We live in strange times.